Years later, reporters would travel to Wilmington to solve the mystery of the cut. Former coaches and teammates alike would tell them that it was for the best, that Jordan wasn't ready, that he was too short, too thin, that he couldn't possibly have beaten the older, stronger players on the varsity even in games of one-on-one. "I always felt he was confident," recalled longtime Wilmington sports writer Chuck Carey. "He just was short and could not do the things he eventually could until he had a growth spurt." Perhaps that was true, although certainly it would be hard to argue against the results of the coming years. Those answers rang with clarity for just about all of the witnesses to the events of 1978, except, of course, for the most important one. Jordan's heart was broken. He wanted to quit the sport and would later credit his mother with challenging him to fight through the immense disappointment. Fortunately, his spirit remained intact that winter. "We thought he'd be better off playing on the JV team," said Fred Lynch, the coach of the younger team and an assistant on the varsity. "He didn't sulk. He worked. We knew Michael was good, but we wanted him to play more." Being on the varsity would have meant a substitute's role, with little playing time, little development, Lynch explained. On the JV, he had room to rule. Still, the status of a junior varsity player came with the usual teen indignities. The players in the Laney program took note of the shape of his head and began calling him Peanut or Shagnut. From baseball, he had had enough of other people selecting his nicknames. "He never answered to it, though," noted Michael Bragg, a junior on the Laney varsity at the time. "Michael judged his game by how he played against the upperclassmen, but he couldn't beat any of them one-on-one until the end of his sophomore year." Jordan's response to the situation became clear on the floor each night the junior varsity played, and soon the members of the varsity made sure to gather to watch the spectacle, hanging on each detail of his performances until it came time for them to get ready for their own game. He scored points in furious bunches, twice even racking up more than 40, an absurd number in contests with six-minute quarters. He averaged 28 points on the season as a playmaking guard. Jordan was only about 5'10" at the time, but one day Kevin Edwards, a senior reserve guard on the varsity, noticed Jordan's hands and held up his own next to them. His was twice as big as mine, he recalled. Large hands make for players who can easily control the ball off the dribble, and that in turn allows for stupendous finishes, as Julius Erving was then demonstrating in professional basketball. Young Michael had begun taking note of the pro game on TV. Later, thanks to the rise of ESPN, the televising of NBA games became omnipresent, and Jordan's own play would spawn a generation of young players attempting to imitate his game. He explained that he had done the same, finding rare and special instructors through television. First, there was David Thompson, followed by the acrobatic Dr. J. "Final game of our sophomore year, we were playing down at Goldsboro. Mike stole the ball and had a breakaway, and he went in and dunked it. I mean, he threw one down," teammate Todd Parker once recalled. "I believe that was the first competitive dunk of his life. We were like, wow, where did that come from?" Jordan would recall that his first in-game dunk had actually occurred at Virgo. "It was a baby dunk, just basic," he remembered. "I didn't even know I did it until after the fact. I surprised myself. Other kids had done it, but still it was spectacular for a junior high kid to be dunking. I felt proud that I could do it." Whether or not it was the first, Jordan's late-season dunk as a sophomore came with the authority of a slam at a time when the college sport had just made the emotional, spectacular play legal again. As baseball was fading for him, Jordan was finding the game that suited his startling athletic skills. At each step along his path, others would express amazement at how hard he competed. At every level, he was driven as if he were pursuing something that others couldn't see. On the basketball court, it was as if everything that he was had been wound into a fury. Combined with his evolving physical gifts, this fury became a spectacle that the many witnesses along the way would never forget. "The first time I ever saw him, I had no idea who Michael Jordan was. I was helping to coach the Laney varsity," recalled Ron Coley in a 1999 newspaper interview. "We went over to Goldsboro, which was our big rival, and I entered the gym when the JV game was just ending up. There were 9 players on the court just coasting, but there was one kid playing his heart out. The way he was playing, I thought his team was down 1 point with 2 minutes to play. So I looked up at the clock, and his team was down 20 points, and there was only 1 minute to play. It was Michael, and I quickly learned he was always like that." Salted Shoes. Jordan was proving prone to the same vagaries of joy and confusion and sorrow that visited so many other adolescents. Despite their own profound troubles, the most important thing his mother and father did was to look beyond themselves. They may have been unwilling to deal with the family's issues of abuse, but James and Dolores Jordan somehow managed to keep a focus on their children. Dolores, in particular, maintained her vigilance and steered her children clear of any possible pitfalls. And James, despite the pressures of work and owning a nightclub, made it to every single event, even if he and his wife kept a distance between them. On a superficial level, this parenting had long been apparent in the time and material gifts they had showered on their children. After the three youngest started school, the Jordans bought them small ponies. Once they reached adolescence, James gave Michael and Larry a small motorbike, an experiment that ended when the boys attempted a daredevil jump over a ramp together and crashed. Then there was the full effort made to support both Larry and Michael in Little League Baseball as the parents traveled back and forth to practices and games, while still holding down demanding jobs. Beyond the gifts and involvement, the greatest impact of their parenting came in the constant shaping of the children's attitudes. They preached a constant refrain: work hard, achieve, set goals, think ahead, don't be denied, be considerate, don't dwell on race. To grow, you have to work hard, Dolores Jordan told them. Discipline yourself and set goals. Her words were perhaps never more important than when her youngest son failed to make the varsity roster as a sophomore. As he said of his career and development, timing was everything. This comment was perhaps the closest he would ever come to acknowledging that what happened to him in the fall of 1978 was a mere stagger step that aided his progress. Perhaps the cut itself might not have wounded him so deeply if not for what happened next. It had been customary for high school coaches at the end of a season to bring the best JV players up to varsity for the district playoffs. Jordan expected that would happen for him. He knew from feedback that people had noticed his play. But Herring and his staff mysteriously said nothing to the sophomore. Apparently, the thought occurred to none of the coaches. Never even discussed it, recalled Coley, Herring's assistant. Jordan took deep offense. As fortune would have it, the team manager took ill as the playoffs were set to begin, which allowed Jordan to devise a plan to accompany the team to its games as a quasi-manager and statistician. He would recall having to carry another player's uniform into the building to avoid having to pay admission. He was so angry, he would rather have spit than cheer for the Laney Buccaneers. They went into the playoffs and I was sitting at the end of the bench, and I couldn't cheer them on because I felt I should have been on that team, he would recall. He had found it hard to cheer for the varsity during his JV season, but he had done it. By the district playoffs, it wasn't possible. This is the only time that I didn't actually cheer for them, he explained. I wanted them to lose. Ironically, I wanted them to lose to prove to them that I could help them. This is what I was thinking at the time. You made a mistake by not putting me on the team, and you're going to see it because you're going to lose. The Buccaneers finished with 15 wins and 7 losses that spring. They did not make the state playoffs after losing 3 of their last 4 games. The experience brought Jordan face to face with his own selfishness for the first time. It would be one of the dominant themes of his career, learning to channel the tremendous drive and ego of his competitive nature into a team game. The other immediate effect of this sophomore setback was that he became obsessed with growing. If coaches could pick a taller player over a talented player for a team, well then, he was just going to have to get taller. He spent hours hanging from a bar in the backyard, hanging anywhere on anything that afforded a good grip, trying to make himself taller. His mother had witnessed everything that had unfolded and talked with him about his anxiety. They prayed together about it, and Jordan prayed alone at the end of each day, and when he woke up in the morning, and all during the day as well. Please, Lord, make me taller. Let me grow. The prospects for that seemed slight. At 5'10", he already towered over the males in the family. His parents counseled him to think about growing in his heart and in his mind. But I want to be taller, he insisted, in almost the same discussion night after night. Finally, his mother told him, go put salt in your shoes and pray. He would tell me I was being silly, but I had to pacify him so I could finish dinner, Mrs. Jordan remembered. Then his dad would walk in and he'd tell him he wanted to be tall. We'd say, you have it in your heart, the tallness is within you, you can be as tall as you want to be in your thinking. So, in addition to hanging from the bar, Jordan would put salt in his shoes before going to bed and praying again. Many nights his mother would bring the salt into his room before bedtime. She didn't have the heart to tell him she had made it all up, that salt was, well, salt. Not long after, an older cousin came to stay with the Jordans, and he was 6'7". 6'7". Suddenly, hope was very much alive. The only concern was the constant pain in Michael's knees. It hurt so much that he could hardly sleep some nights. His mother took him to the doctor about the pain and his desire to grow. The doctor took one look at the x-rays and saw the growth plates and told mother and son not to worry. Young Michael still had plenty of growing to do. Indeed, by summer he had shot to 6'3 and was far from done. In fact, he would continue growing right into college and even a bit in the NBA until he was 6'6 and towered a foot above everyone else in his family. Mike was about 5'10 at the end of 10th grade, no more than 5'11. He always had talent, Fred Lynch remembered. He was our best 9th grader and our best 10th grader. He played with a lot of heart. He had guard skills, and he always had big, strong hands. By his junior year, he shot up to 6'3, almost 6'4. All of a sudden, you had size to go with that talent and drive. He just blossomed. Chapter 7, Number 23. In the spring of 1979, Irvin Magic Johnson, a sophomore at Michigan State, had just led his Spartans to the NCAA championship over senior Larry Bird and the Indiana State Sycamores. Their meeting, featuring an emerging black star from the Big Ten Conference against an emerging white one from a little-known university in Indiana, had triggered the nation's curiosity, measured by the largest television audience ever to watch an NCAA title game. Among that infatuated mass was young Michael Jordan of Wilmington, North Carolina, and he kept watching the next season as Bird joined the Boston Celtics and Johnson took his talents to the Los Angeles Lakers, two of pro basketball's storied franchises. The following spring, when Johnson carried the Lakers to an NBA title with a magical display of talent, his spell over young Mike was complete. The teen in Wilmington was in love with the Lakers. They were his team, and Magic Johnson was his guy. That same year, Jordan's parents gave him his first automobile. Knowing just the way to his heart, Jordan's girlfriend, Laquita Robinson, bought him a vanity plate that he displayed proudly on the front bumper of his new ride, Magic Mike. Certain basketball people, many of them coaches, would later smile ruefully at such a revelation. Bird and Johnson were both big men, 6'9 each, who handled the basketball beautifully and played in the open court with a verve that inspired millions of new NBA fans. Both were brilliant passers, particularly Johnson, but both could deliver the ball to teammates in ways that brought a rush of blood to the hearts of all who saw it. The sport had never seen someone like Johnson running the fast break. Over the summer and fall of 1979, as Magic Johnson was still basking in the joy of his NCAA tournament win and his selection by the Lakers, Michael Jordan was in Wilmington and about to ignite his own roiling legend. That fall, Jordan would begin play for the Laney High School Buccaneers. While his skills were far from perfect, his effort in those first varsity games was something to behold. His prayers for more height had been answered. He had grown to 6'3 and was already headed to 6'4. His hands were larger, his arms longer, his stride greater. He had new tools with which to expand his game. While he had been aggressive offensively as a sophomore point guard on the junior varsity squad, he was also mindful of distributing the ball to his teammates. As they watched his considerable talents unfold on the varsity, Laney coach Pop Herring and his assistants soon saw that Jordan was far too unselfish. He was so talented he needed to do more scoring to help the relatively inexperienced team rather than deferring to someone else, Herring concluded. Jordan listened closely to his coaches, but was hesitant to change. He still believed that basketball was a team game, and he was going to look for his teammates. Finally, Pop Herring turned to James Jordan and asked for his help. The father was at first reluctant, explaining that he never cared much for the kind of father who didn't leave the coaching to the coach. Getting involved would violate that principle. Ultimately, though, he relented and urged his son to do what his coaches asked. At this urging, Michael began to take on more individually, which in turn revealed even more of his gift. It was then that the pattern was established. The more he did, the more his coaches and his audience wanted him to do, and the more it began to please him to discover just what he was capable of doing. His game and his image then began to feed on themselves, still only subtly, in those early days of his career. but it would soon enough become clear that everything about him was beginning to multiply. To those around him, including his parents, this development wasn't troubling at first, but later it would grow obvious that his success was accompanied by a burden. The greater his success, the greater the weight, and it would never go away, no matter how leveraged the lifting. The Varsity. Bobby Kremins, the 31-year-old head coach at Appalachian State, was both happy and tired in 1979 as he went about the business of running his summer camps. A former point guard for Frank McGuire at the University of South Carolina, Kremins had spent 4 difficult years building the program at Appalachian, a gem of a public university in the Carolina Mountains. That effort had just been rewarded in 1979 by his team's first trip to the NCAA tournament, where his appropriately named Mountaineers promptly lost to LSU. The excitement had just begun to settle that June as Kremins opened his camp for high school teams. The camp allowed teams to get away to North Carolina's cool upper elevations for some summer hoops, and at the same time, it afforded a young coach like Kremins the opportunity to look at a range of players he might not otherwise get to scout. Kremins was watching the Laney High team from Wilmington when he noticed the player with the spindly legs, whose energy and athleticism sent a charge through the camp's games and drills. The more Kremins watched, the more his amazement grew. Finally, Kremins dialed up Bob Givens, the editor of a local basketball talent poop sheet, and said excitedly in his thick New York accent, "Bob, there's a kid up here you're not going to believe." In a few short years, Gibbons would become known as one of the high priests of high school basketball talent, but at the time his publication had a small readership. Kremins's raving about an unknown player, one who hadn't even played a varsity game, piqued Gibbons's interest, so he drove over to Appalachian State to take a look for himself. "I saw a 6'3 player with explosive athletic ability," Gibbons told writer Al Featherston. "But what impressed me was what Michael said when Bobby introduced him to me. Mr. Gibbons, what do I need to do to be a better player?" Kremins and Gibbons weren't the only surprised observers. Jordan's own teammates would later recall witnessing a startling transformation. "He comes back for junior year, he's a different guy, no longer skinny little Mike," remembered Todd Parker, a Laney teammate. "He's jumping out of the gym. I'm like, what?" "I could see a real big difference," agreed Mike Bragg, a senior on the Laney varsity at the time. "He was much more determined, and he had more ability." Gibbons didn't know any background about this transformation, but he made note of Jordan's potential in his next report, the scout recalled. "I wrote about what a good prospect he was, but I only had a couple of hundred readers and a small regional audience. I certainly wasn't the one people were talking about," Jordan said of his time that summer at Appalachian State. "No one knew me that much." Pop Herring, though, took note of the interest in Jordan and was pleased. It confirmed his belief that he was about to coach someone very special. Herring was not given to braggadocio, but the record speaks remarkably well of his actions despite Jordan's obsession with the cut. There is nothing to indicate that Herring thought about how he might exploit this singular talent, as coaches were often known to do. The record does show that Herring took every opportunity to expand the youthful Jordan's options. In fact, the coach would deftly manage his players' recruitment by colleges, which got off to a very slow start, then blew up almost overnight. In the fall of 1979, before the storm, Herring sat down and composed a letter seeking interest in Jordan from the University of North Carolina coaching staff. Not every high school coach took an interest in the future of his players, and it was extremely rare for a coach to write such a letter before a player had even participated in a varsity game. But that's what Herring did, along with rising early each weekday morning to pick up Jordan at 6:30 to work on his game. "He had a weakness with his left hand," Herring once recalled. "I told him to improve with the left hand and work on shooting off the dribble." The early morning sessions focused on those things and on getting up as many shots as possible. So much of Jordan's later success was seated in the extraordinary efforts of the young coach. From several accounts, Herring and Jordan would become quite close, but never close enough to allow Jordan to forget his rejection as a sophomore. Thinking back on all those early mornings in the Laney gym, Jordan would recall, "Whenever I was working out and got tired and figured I'd ought to stop, I'd close my eyes and see that list in the locker room without my name on it, and that usually got me going again." That fall, Herring called Jordan into his office to consult about a jersey number for the upcoming season. He gave the junior a choice of 2 numbers, James Beatty's 23 or Dave McGee's 33, the team's 2 all-district seniors who had graduated. Apparently something of a numerologist, Jordan decided he'd like to wear Beatty's 23. Years later, he explained that he made the selection because 23 was close to half of 45, a number that his brother Larry had worn. Before he would be done, coaches across basketball would come to understand the number as a sign. Whether in AAU play or public school leagues or even a recreation contest for 10-year-olds, coaches began to figure that anyone bold enough to wear 23 must deserve extra defensive attention. Likewise, future generations of the best young players would vie to wear the number 23 and take on the pressure and expectation that came with it. For Jordan, the number would soon enough become a signature that would brand everything from his line of boutiques to the sky blue personal jet that he used to hop about the planet from one exclusive resort to another in search of the perfect golf round. The first sizzling moment in his emergence that varsity season happened to come in a road game in Pender County, of all places. There, before a collection of family, friends, and distant cousins, he scored 35 points to carry Laney to an 81-79 overtime win in the first game of the season. His family, his teammates, his coaches, even Jordan himself, all were taken aback by the display. From there, his pent-up emotion and frustration erupted game after game as he took off on a high-octane spin through everything he had dreamed about. The early ferocity just leapt at anyone watching. Time and again, as he attacked the basket, his mouth would fly open like the intake valve on a dragster, sucking in air along the way with enough G-force to pin his lips high on his gums. His exposed teeth flared vampire-like, as if he were about to devour the rim itself. The tongue popped out for no other reason than to get out of the way of it all. He did this over and over while charging the basket. His visage alone was enough to give defenders pause. And when he took rebounds, he rose up and snatched the ball with the same ferocity. His quickness off the floor left teammates and opponents alike agape. He presented a physical challenge that quickly separated him from the boys around him. A select few took on the challenge of rising up with him, but many simply resorted to principle of verticality poses, throwing their arms straight up and hoping for the best. Among the many who took notice was Mike Brown, the athletic director of New Hanover County Schools. He had been wowed by Jordan's opening salvos as a varsity player, so much so that he contacted Bill Guthridge, Dean Smith's top assistant at the University of North Carolina, and told him there was an exceptional young guard in Wilmington that he needed to see. Like that, the seed was planted. The Laney lineup also included Leroy Smith in the post and senior Mike Bragg at guard. Another guard forward was senior Adolph Shiver, whom Jordan had gotten to know a few years earlier on the courts at Wilmington's Empey Park. Shiver was a chippy sort, always talking trash with a toothpick hanging out of his mouth, Jordan recalled. While Shiver's behavior frequently annoyed others, he seemed mostly to amuse Jordan with a constant chatter and trash talking, much as the court jester might entertain the king. One time, Jordan threw Shiver up against a wall after Shiver insulted David Bridgers' sweetheart, but there was something in Shiver's edginess that endeared him to Jordan. It also seems likely that Shiver's presence and attitude brought Jordan some street cred in high school. In turn, Shiver fed off Jordan's vast energy, as did everyone on the Laney varsity, even the coaches. The two began a friendship that carried far into adult life. The bond between them began with Jordan finding Shiver reliable as a teammate. Time would reveal Jordan to be steadfastly loyal to the tight circle of friends he accumulated in his life. Shiver was merely the first to pass the audition. Jordan would come to accept some questionable behavior from his friends, but not disloyalty. Trust was a precious commodity for Jordan, and he would establish a bond of trust with Shiver that first varsity season. By Jordan's Chicago days, Shiver would be in the hotel suites on the nights before big games, dealing hands of tonk to help relax his old pal. The Buccaneers got another win in their second game, with Jordan exploding for 29 points, this time at home, but then came the inevitable wake-up call. Southern Wayne had a team that featured two of Jordan's future college teammates, big man Cecil Exum and point guard Linwood Robinson, both considered blue-chip players at the time. Against Laney, Robinson scored 27 and Exum 24. Jordan's 28 points raised yet more eyebrows, but his dazzling performance didn't prevent the loss. Southern Wayne embarrassed the Buccaneers 83-58. Herring could only whistle afterward. "It'll help us playing somebody this good," he said, trying to put a positive spin on the drubbing. "Jordan is just a junior, and we'll all get better as the season goes on. We have to regroup. We got spanked tonight." Laney looked better 3 nights later with Jordan and Leroy Smith ripping down rebounds and powering out on the fast break. Michael's 24 points led Laney past crosstown rival Hoggard with help from brother Larry, who came off the bench to score 6. The older Jordan would have his moments during the season, but he also spent a lot of time sitting and simply admiring the player his kid brother was becoming. We played 1 year of varsity basketball together when I was a senior and Michael was a junior, and that's when his play just went to another level, Larry would recall later. Even though there were 5 guys on the floor, he pretty much played all 5 positions. His level of play was just so much higher than the rest of us. People ask me all the time if it bothered me, but I can honestly say no, because I had the opportunity to see him grow. I knew how hard he worked. Despite the intensity of their earlier sibling rivalry, Larry proved to be another remarkable element in Michael's good fortune. His fundamental decency and patience evidenced itself in the absence of drama on the Laney varsity. Not many high school seniors could tolerate sitting on the bench night after night, watching a younger sibling rival grab the public's attention. In fact, all of the family would be caught off guard by Michael's suddenly elevated status, even James and Dolores. I remember going to Laney High on a Friday night, Michael's junior year, and now he'd grown, James's younger brother Gene Jordan would later recall. Before the game, he's telling me, "Watch me, I'm going to slam dunk 3 balls tonight. You'll see, I'm going to slam 3." And I'm there saying, "Boy, who you kidding? You can't slam no ball." Well, he didn't slam 3, but he sure as hell slammed 2. And I told my brother that night, "Hey, that boy is devastating." A few other keen observers agreed. Laney's top player has been Mike Jordan, Chuck Curry noted in the Wilmington paper on December 18th. A night later, Jordan scored 31 in a win over Kinston and earned his first headline, "Jordan Paces Bucks Past Kinston." With the early wins, Laney's record stood at 4-1, and Herring grew even more optimistic. "This is the best defensive team in my tenure here at Laney," Herring declared. The defensive success depended partly on Jordan's ability to get into the passing lanes and his attention to rebounding. He played wing on offense, but played a mix of guard and forward on defense, thanks to his quickness and recovery speed. Like his idol Magic Johnson, he spent much time around the basket defensively, with the idea of collecting rebounds and quickly getting the ball back up the court. Years later, he would look back with amusement on the explosion of his raw power in high school. The unbridled nature of the experience showed him the kinds of things he could do athletically, things about which even the best coaches had no earthly concept. As basketball evolved, another theme began to emerge. The sport, more than any other, furthered the process of whites understanding and coming to terms with the rise of black athletes. This process had begun during the first years of integration, well before Jordan appeared on the scene. But in those first decades of racial collaboration in basketball, many white coaches had a limited understanding of the athletic style of play that had developed in black communities. The only way coaches could learn it was to witness it in action. In high school and later at the University of San Francisco in the 1950s, coaches had cautioned Bill Russell not to leave his feet to block opponents' shots. Russell tried it their way briefly, then followed what his instincts told him, to rise up and block shots like no one ever had. "We were born to play like we do," Jordan would later observe in a conversation with writer John Edgar Wideman. "Can't teach it." Of all the coaches Jordan played for, only the first 2 were African-American. Fred Lynch and Pop Herring were able to sit and watch Jordan explore the range of his special athleticism in those high school years. They did so without sounding excessive alarms about his violation of one or another of the game's fundamentals. Lynch and Herring worked with him on basketball's basics and helped him channel his unique athleticism. Herring would show him how to maximize his quickness in his first step with a move that would later prompt college officials to call traveling violations on him at North Carolina until Dean Smith was able to demonstrate that Jordan was not using an extra step. The record shows that Herring spent much time talking to Jordan and his teammates about shot selection and the tempo at which they would play, just as he focused on their defensive unity. "Jordan made such talks easy," assistant coach Ron Coley remembered. "Nobody ever had that kid's drive, even in high school. He took pride in his defense. Mike was furious if his teammates didn't play good defense in practice." As much as he praised his team, Herring was pointedly limited in his public commentary about Jordan in those early months. Nor did the coach talk about the letters he wrote or his work with the young player those early mornings in the gym. So many coaches viewed their teams and players in terms of their own professional resumes, but Herring kept his efforts to himself. They would become known only much later, mostly from Jordan's recollections. Little did Herring know it at the time, but Jordan's moment would be his own brief moment. The coach's actions were not perfect, but in retrospect, they were clearly extraordinary. Herring was enthusiastic but restrained in most of his efforts with his inexperienced team that season. Considering Jordan's height and leaping ability, most coaches would have kept him inside near the basket or working along the baseline. While Jordan worked all over the floor, Herring played him mostly at guard. Pop gave him the opportunity to play the position he was going to play in college and the pros, New Hanover coach Jim Hebron observed. If Pop had played him inside or on the baseline, he might have won the state title. The Spreading Word. 2 days after Christmas, Laney opened play in the Star News New Hanover Invitational, which Herring's team had won the previous season. The event pitted local schools against talent from as far away as New York. Up first for Laney was Wadesboro Bowman, a team that had traveled from South Central North Carolina. "We had heard about him," Wadesboro coach Bill Thacker recalled in 2011. "Some of our kids thought they could play like Michael Jordan, but they weren't up to the task." In particular, his team featured an athletic player named Tim Sterling, Thacker recalled. He thought he could match MJ dunk for dunk. It was really a neat game, going up and down. The teams traded blows at a furious pace, driven by Laney's pressing and trapping. With 6 minutes left and Laney leading 46-44, Herring called a timeout to give his players a breather and to remind them to focus on good shots down the stretch. The one thing that had worried him in their early wins was his team's tendency to get out of control. The game tightened a bit and stood at 48-all with 3:47 to go. Having gained their poise, Jordan and his teammates once again turned up their defensive energy and shot off on an 18-2 run that closed it out 66-50. "Our kids turned in a good defensive effort all night, and it was really good down the stretch," Herring said afterward, particularly Jordan. "He had a lot of energy, a lot of energy," Thacker recalled. Those late-game expectations failed to pay off in the semifinals the next day against Holy Cross, a team that had driven 15 hours from Flushing, New York. Laney was up by 6 midway through the fourth period and led 51-47 with 2 minutes to go. But Jordan missed 2 free throws with 45 seconds on the clock, which allowed Holy Cross to tie it. Jordan got an open look at the buzzer, but again missed, and from there Holy Cross got control in overtime and won 65-61. Afterward, Herring was quite angry. "They're supposed to do a job," he complained to a reporter. "We had a meeting about it." What he did next perhaps foreshadowed the mental instability to come. It's possible that he just didn't want to give rival New Hanover a look at his starters, or maybe he was simply angry. Herring benched his starters the next day for the entire third-place game against New Hanover. Perplexed and steamed, Jordan watched as his teammates played well but lost 53-50. Whatever his purpose, the move backfired on Herring. His team plummeted through 5 straight losses over the next 3 weeks, although the setbacks weren't without highlights. Jordan scored 40 against powerful Goldsboro and Anthony Tichy, who would later star for Wake Forest. Tichy blocked 17 Laney shots that night, which left Herring shaking his head after the 72-64 loss. "Tichy was just unbelievable," he said. "Blocking 17 shots is unbelievable." Perhaps the backstory helps to explain Jordan's 40-point outburst that night. At 16, he was dating a girl from Goldsboro, about 2 hours northwest of Wilmington, which meant overnight trips to visit her. The girlfriend, Laquita Robinson, lived in Tichy's neighborhood, so the Goldsboro star had encountered Jordan from time to time. "He was seeing a girl, a classmate of mine, so he knew people here in Goldsboro," Tichy recalled in a 2012 interview. "He would come to Goldsboro a lot." Even then, Jordan had a certain air about him, Tichy remembered. He kept things close. He carried that aura about him. He carried that with him on the court, too. If he didn't know you, he was not going to hang out with you off the court. If he didn't know you, he wasn't going to hold a conversation with you. It wasn't that Jordan was rude. He was friendly enough, Tichy recalled. He just didn't trust a lot of people. Jordan obviously wanted to make an impression against his girlfriend's school. The best measure of an extra spark? The star of one team scored 40 points, and the star of the other blocked 17 shots. Tichy couldn't recall how many of the shots he swatted that night were Jordan's, but acknowledged he was attacking the goal quite a bit. Goldsboro's veteran coach, Norvell Lee, had already heard a lot from his contacts about Jordan that first varsity season, Tichy recalled with a laugh. "My high school coach said we needed to start checking him as soon as he got off the bus. The offense that they had, he was pretty much it." Tichy recalled Jordan talking trash that night, but not directing any of it at him. He already had the advantage as far as his talent, Tichy explained. I think he knew that. But then the talking game, to add that in? There wasn't too much you could do, because whatever he said, he did. Jordan showed surprising polish for a first-year varsity player. At that time, I didn't see any real weakness in his game, Tichy remembered. Somehow, he had been able to open up his game at an early age. He wasn't really doing a lot of dunking. He was showing his mid-range, and he had range, too. It wasn't one side or the other. It was all over the court. He could pull up or drive. He had the green light, too. That would become more obvious with each succeeding game. Jordan rang up 26 two nights later in another loss, their second to rival New Hanover. Again, he was the only Laney player in double figures. Next, lowly Jacksonville beat them on a made free throw after time expired. Jordan scored 17 but made only 7 of 14 free throws on a night that the entire team shot 36% from the line. Bill Guthridge, whose keen eye for talent Dean Smith prized, went down to Wilmington in early 1980 to see what all the fuss was about, but by the time he could scout Jordan, the Laney Buccaneers had slipped into their losing streak and Jordan himself had gone a bit adrift. Guthridge watched him clang a number of long jumpers and reported back to Smith that this particular prospect had ample athleticism and superior quickness and had played very hard throughout the game, but that he had spent much of the time jacking up shots that reduced his efficiency. Guthridge told Smith that Jordan was unmilked. Still, it was decided that Jordan was obviously an ACC-level talent and that Carolina would need to see more of him. Smith never liked for his recruiting targets to become public knowledge, and that was true with Jordan as well, although the excitement of their apparent discovery did leak out. Archansky, who was covering Carolina for a local newspaper, was a close friend of assistant coach Eddie Fogler. "Even though I was a newspaper guy, I kept things confidential that they told me," Chansky recalled. "I knew that he was on their radar, and that they thought he was a lot better than he thought he was. Michael was just hoping to get a scholarship somewhere. He was thinking about going into the Air Force. That's what kind of late bloomer he was. He was just flying under the radar at Laney." When Carolina started to recruit guys, not only did everybody else start paying attention, but the kids' ratings would start going up in all the recruiting ratings. Sometimes it would backfire in a kid, because everybody thought he was great and he didn't turn out to be that good. Roy Williams, a Carolina graduate assistant, had first been assigned to scout Jordan, but couldn't do it due to a conflict. Apparently, Williams tipped one source that the Tar Heels had some interest in Jordan. He phoned Brick Ettinger, a friend who covered recruiting for an ACC tip sheet. "Roy told me I had to keep the tip secret because Coach Smith didn't want the media people talking about him," Ettinger recalled many years later. "He told me, there's this guy named Mike Jordan at Laney. Coach Guthridge has been to see him 3 times. He does 360-degree dunks like it's nothing." Jordan wasn't aware of the small buzz that had been generated among the recruiting writers. In fact, he hadn't learned that North Carolina was scouting him until after Guthridge's visit. Herring didn't tell Jordan, most likely because he didn't want to make his star player nervous. When Jordan did learn of the visit, he was both surprised and excited, and got a boost to his confidence, which had sagged a bit with his mid-season shooting struggles. "I never thought I'd be able to play Division I ball," he said of that period in his development. "I was really happy and enthusiastic that they were even interested. I was happy someone was interested." Part of his difficulties on the court had come from the fact that opposing coaches had begun devising plans to contain him. As word spread, Jordan encountered far more defensive attention from opponents than he had earlier in the season. Jordan found himself facing ever bigger challenges as opponents adjusted to his play. The answer to the question of his ability would lie in how well he adjusted to the adjustment, so to speak. As January became February in 1980, Jordan showed that he was adjusting quite well, that he could still produce big efforts in the face of additional defenders. He had just crossed the first big hurdle of his career. The use of videotape for scouting had yet to become prominent in basketball at any level, so the opposing coaches in the Coastal Plains Division II Conference could work only from memory and play charts that first varsity season. Still, Jordan had given them and North Carolina's coaches plenty to see. Later, as he advanced into college and professional basketball, his performances would send opponents more and more into the film room to study his game, to look for a means of containing him. The accounts vary between Dean Smith and Roy Williams as to exactly how the Carolina staff felt about Jordan after watching him that first time. "Bill Guthridge is an outstanding judge of talent," Dean Smith later recalled. "And after seeing Michael the first time, he said he was an ACC player, but we weren't sure we would go after him. On one thing, the various accounts agree. The Carolina coaches wanted to get him into Smith's camp that summer to see just how good he might be. Jordan's performance over the final weeks of the 1980 season gave them no reason for pause. With their seventh victory against five losses, Laney High headed out to visit Southern Wayne with Robinson and Exum. Jordan was ill and lay quietly in the back of the bus, which assistant coach Ron Coley would recall 17 years later after Jordan fought off illness to lead the Bulls to a win over the Utah Jazz in an NBA Finals game. In 1980, he was just gaining the first sense of his tremendous ability to focus and how certain setbacks, such as illness or some particular slight, could send that focus to even higher intensity. Herring went to a slowdown offense that night, which almost allowed the Buccaneers to pull off the upset before falling 36-34. Jordan scored just 7 points, including two at the end of the game on a meaningless heave, as most of the points came inside from Shiver and Smith. From there, Laney added a win over Hoggard, and then took on Kinston in a back-and-forth affair. With a minute to go and the score tied at 51, Herring called a timeout and put his team in the four corners offense to spread the floor. This time, however, there was something different. Larry Jordan was off the bench with the ball in his hands, and when he saw his opening, he drove down the middle of the lane and scored on a layup. Jordan Brothers dump Kinston read the headline the next morning in the Wilmington Star News. Larry Jordan came off the bench and did well, Herring told sportswriter Chuck Caree. Game experience has been his only problem. Larry's younger brother helped the cause with 29 points. Next, they lost at New Bern, then faced Goldsboro and Anthony Tichy again, this time in Wilmington. It didn't matter. Jordan still struggled against his girlfriend's hometown. He scored just 2 points in the first half. He recovered with 15 in the final two quarters, which drove their comeback from 15 down. The Buccaneers caught up but couldn't close it out, which left Herring complaining afterward that he was tired of getting overwhelmed by Goldsboro. The loss dropped Laney's record to 9-9 on the season and put in peril their hopes for a first-round home game in the playoffs. After that was their final showdown with rival New Hanover in Wilmington. New Hanover coach Jim Hebron had studied Jordan and set up his defense accordingly. Laney's last 4 games of the season, though, would reveal just how much Herring's team had grown. The coach rebalanced Laney's attack. Jordan scored 21 as New Hanover's lineup collapsed on him, but he had far more help, with Shiver adding 17 and Mike Bragg 16. Pop deserves a lot of credit, Hebron said after Laney got the win. 2 nights later, Shiver scored 24 to go with Jordan's 18 as Laney defeated Jacksonville in Wilmington. That was followed by a Valentine's Day victory over Eastern Wayne in which Jordan discovered a rhythm that would become familiar to him over the years, what he would come to call the math of big games. He scored 15 of his team's 22 points in the second period, then added 7 more in the third and 11 in the fourth to finish with a school record 42 points. The performance had a little bit of everything, jumpers, transition baskets, a couple of dunks. Best of all, it hadn't turned his teammates into spectators. Shiver, who was learning to find his scoring opportunities alongside his horse, finished with 14. Acting on Roy Williams' tip, basketball writer Brick Ettinger went to see Laney's big win over Eastern Wayne in February 1980. Jordan was just fabulous, Ettinger recalled. He was out of sight. When you saw him play, it was like, how could this guy not have even made the team the year before? In fact, Ettinger turned to his friends that night and said, the coach had to have been an idiot. Ettinger was clearly excited. I wrote in our next issue, February of 1980, that you probably haven't heard the name Mike Jordan, but he has the best combination of athleticism, basketball skills, and intangibles of any high school wing guard that I've ever seen. The victory allowed Laney to secure third place in the 4A Division II Conference, the state's highest classification. Goldsboro and Southern Wayne are two of the best teams in the state, and there's no disgrace finishing behind them, Herring told the Star. For Laney, the finish meant a home game to open the district tournament. Jordan came out aggressively and quickly found foul trouble, so he watched as his teammates again demonstrated their balance. Shiver scored 17, Jordan 20, Leroy Smith 13, and Mike Bragg 9 to beat Hoggard. Laney then traveled to Dudley to take on Southern Wayne, one of North Carolina's top-ranked teams with a 21-2 record, in the District 2 semifinal. Southern Wayne would go on to win the state championship that year, and Linwood Robinson would be named MVP of the tournament. The Buccaneers almost derailed Southern Wayne's championship run that night by playing a tight 1-2-2 zone that allowed them to push the issue to overtime. Southern Wayne coach Marshall Hamilton threw a furious mix of defenses into the effort of stopping Jordan, using triangle and two, diamond and one, man-to-man, even a full-court press, anything to keep pressure on him. Jordan shook it all off in the first half to score 12 points, but the changing defenses began to take their toll over the second half and the overtime, when Jordan managed just 6 points. Hamilton's strategy worked, and his team survived the tense affair 40-35, Laney's season ending at 13-11. The final game, however, documented Jordan's growing maturity. "We have so much trouble matching up with Jordan, but everybody does," Hamilton observed afterward. "The thing that makes him so good is that he's so patient. We could hurt someone like that if all he did was shoot, because we could force him into bad shots. Jordan just doesn't take any." He had averaged 24.6 points and 11.9 rebounds on the season. "What more can I say about Michael?" Herring told the Star News after the season. "He's as good a player as I've seen through here since the New Hanover State Championship year in 1968. I think he's going to be great. He's already a great shooter and scorer, and he doesn't think the world revolves around Michael Jordan." Better yet, the coach had started to gain a sense that he was helping Jordan build a future. "Coach Guthridge has watched him," Herring pointed out, "so the big schools know he's around." Chapter 8: The Transformation. Michael Jordan had felt isolated his sophomore year, worried that he hadn't made many real friends in the much larger school. He was an outgoing jokester, but inside he struggled with the uncertainty that so many 15-year-olds feel. His self-doubt had been compounded by his inability to make the varsity basketball team that first year at Laney. "You know how kids worry and think," he said later, looking back on the fact that his sudden height also played a role in his self-image. Already thin, he had become almost blade-like with the growth. "I was really lanky, really tall, so I stood out. That can present problems when you're a kid." There was a sense that even when people smiled or joked with him, they were somehow laughing at him. Others saw it differently, however. Laney seemed like a family back then, Leroy Smith recalled. It had about a 60-40 white-to-black ratio, but it was really cool. No tension or anything. It was a new school. For there to be no real sides, that was unusual. Mike being Mike, he was unusual too. We all were searching for an identity. But Mike, it was like he'd already found his. Nonetheless, Jordan seemed to think that he was hopeless socially. "I always thought I would be a bachelor," he remembered. "I couldn't get a date. I kidded around too much. I always used to play around with women. I was a clown. I picked at people a lot. That was my way of breaking the ice with people who were very serious. I was good in school. I'd get A's and B's in my classes, but I'd get N's and U's in conduct because I was kidding around, talking all the time." His older sister recalled a loving, upbeat Michael during this period. She was now married and somewhat distanced from the family. In those days, he was often the one who reached out to her. He looked up to her husband and enjoyed spending time with her family. She had two children, whom Michael adored. He had long had an easy way with children. Where other boys his age might have been indifferent to these delicate little creatures, he delighted in them almost from the very start, sweeping them up in his arms as they grew into toddlers. "He likes kids," his father would explain later. "I guess because kids theoretically are active people. And Michael is pretty active. He has completely spoiled my daughter's two kids to death. Even the younger children in the neighborhood were attracted to him and would drop by just because Michael was a ready playmate," his father explained. In some ways, it wasn't just that he loved children. He was eager to please and just wanted attention from anyone who would give it. It quickly became clear to him during and after that junior season that basketball could deliver attention like nothing else he had attempted. His rapid elevation as a varsity star meant that everywhere he went in Laney's hallways, he was now met with smiling faces and comments about his play. It transformed his status, from a life on the margins to big man on campus, in a way that most teens can only dream about. He would attribute it all to the strength of the group dynamics on the team. "Before I started playing basketball in high school, I didn't have a lot of friends," Jordan said that April, looking back on his first electric season. "It helped me get to know people. I love my teammates. They have helped me and I have helped them. Teamwork, that's what counts. I've found that as you get better and better in athletics, you make friends or meet people that are better and better people. You make better friends." He couldn't have gotten better without the people around him, he said. "I would like to give my coaches and teammates credit for it." Although he was only 17 at the time, His off-the-cuff comments reflected a significant understanding of the impact of the things that were happening to him. 30 years later, there would be many people who, upon hearing his harsh comments during his induction to the Hall of Fame, surely wished that he had remembered those words of wisdom as a teen. But so many challenges lay ahead, and to meet them, he would turn time and again to his talisman, the diamond-hard disappointment that he seemed to wear around his neck. His favorite subject in school was math, and it was in math class that his youthful change was most dramatic, according to Janice Hardy, who taught him first algebra and later trigonometry. The first year I had him, he was scared to death. I liked that. The next year, he wound up in the front row. He'd laugh at my jokes and muss my hair. He had longed for popularity, and when it came, it seemed he couldn't get enough of it, hurrying to fill the part of his life that wasn't consumed by sports. He could never be in his room by himself, his mother remembered. He always had to go out, spend the night with a friend, go camping. Dolores Jordan greeted Michael's success with quiet enthusiasm, although it wasn't entirely clear whether her dominant emotion was relief or joy. Whatever the root, the product was a blossoming pride. Her youngest child, Rosalind, had turned to academics to earn parental approval. The younger daughter, who was close with her mother, had a secret plan to finish high school a year early so that she could graduate with Michael and head off to college at the same time. Not surprisingly, her efforts stirred Michael's competitiveness, and while he couldn't match Rosalind's showing, the circumstances helped him register solid grades, which made him all the more appealing to the colleges that would soon vie to recruit him. Easily the biggest difference between Michael and his younger sister was that no newspaper reporters showed up to interview the family when Rosalind made the honor roll. Michael's growing prowess would stir the media's inquisitiveness about his upbringing over the coming years, and Dolores Jordan was ready to answer their questions. She would talk proudly about the record of her younger children. They knew that they had to come straight home after school, she told a Wilmington writer. They could have no visitors in the house until the parents got home. They got off the bus, came in and got a sandwich, and did their homework. Academics were always very important. But you've also got to be involved with your children. You can't just bundle them up and send them off. You have to support them, go to the PTO meetings, and learn as much about them and what they're doing as you can. All they're searching for is love and attention. We kept together a lot. We knew where they were all the time and who they were associating with. She was clearly proud of the effort with her brood. But Dolores Jordan sensed that she and her husband had raised two families gained clarity in this period. Often at odds with her older daughter, Dolores had watched Sis's life blow up in family conflict, and oldest son Ronnie had faced his own conflicts with James, which may well have played a role in his hurrying off to the army. Maturing children have always sought escape from the watchful eye of their parents, but given the divisions in the Jordan household, it seems no surprise that their children were looking to be elsewhere. The Jordans had brought abundance to the lives of their offspring, yet it was hard to avoid the fact that escape had become a theme in their lives. If there was any mystery in all of this, it was Dolores Jordan's relationship with her own parents. She rarely mentioned her upbringing in her many interviews over the years, or even in her book. But her children readily acknowledged their mother's awkwardness with her widowed father. James and Dolores usually drove right past his house in Pender County on their way to the many visits with Ms. Bell and Medward. When they did stop to visit with Edward Peoples, Sis remembered a cold and intimidating atmosphere in the house. Medward Jordan had his own brand of intimidation, but it was nothing like the apparent gulf between Dolores and Edward Peoples. It seems likely that she was dealing with her own history of fatherly disapproval. At the very least, the circumstances in the Peoples household had been difficult with her pregnancy and subsequent departure. However, there was no question that her discipline and high expectations for her younger children were drawn from her family background. The Peoples had employed this same singleness of purpose in grinding out their hard-won success in the unforgiving business of farming. Edward Peoples's accomplishments perhaps seem trivial compared with the wealth his grandson would amass, but when considered in terms of degree of difficulty, his rise through the harsh challenges of sharecropping to own and manage his own land was an immense feat. Something in that process had led to a mysterious estrangement, and not just from her father. Over the coming years, as the Jordans were drawn into the magical world of their youngest son's success, Sis observed that they seemed to harbor a growing embarrassment about the homespun nature of James's parents as well, of all the older generations that had come up on the land. It was almost as if James and Dolores were trying to put the world of Teachy and Rocky Point behind them. James and Dolores Jordan were also being tugged in another direction, drawn into their son's shared sports dream. This was a family that would go anywhere and do anything to pursue a sports opportunity for their children. Such behavior would become a prominent feature of family life at the end of the century, but the Jordans were well ahead of the curve. The games themselves would become a powerful drug, riveting the family's attention with the anticipation, the thrill of competition, and the afterglow. They'd immediately be eager for the next game, for the whole thing to start all over again. They were, perhaps, the original helicopter parents. It became a happy addiction in those first months of the uptick. They'd been obsessively following their kids in sports for years, and now, here was the sign of a big payoff. They'd been through the highs of Michael's Little League Baseball, only to fall to reality with the Babe Ruth competition. But basketball seemed to be the real thing. Coaches from the University of North Carolina had come calling. Feedback like that allowed them to imagine the future. The Carolina coaches had invited Michael to their summer camp. It all smelled very good, except for one little matter. James Jordan's priority as a parent that spring was to get his youngest son to accept the idea of work. He had badgered Michael about it relentlessly. It was an embarrassment for the entire family. Dolores fretted and worried about it too, until she came up with the notion of asking H.L. Whitey Pravat for some help. He was a nice man, a customer at the bank where she worked. He owned a hotel and restaurant. So she asked about a job for her son. "I can't say enough about his mother," Pravat recalled. "She was a bank teller, and we used to do business there. She called and asked if there was anything Michael could do here." "I was a hotel maintenance man," Jordan remembered. "I was cleaning out pools, painting rails, changing air conditioner filters, and sweeping out the back room. The job paid Michael minimum wage, $3.10 an hour." Who could have imagined that the one and only paycheck stub of his entire working career, a slip from Whitey's for $119.76, would one day wind up in a display case at the Cape Fear Museum in Wilmington as part of its Jordan collection? "That thing has sent me a lot of business," Pravat would confide to a reporter years later. "I had people from Germany come in here one time, asking about him because they saw the stub at the museum." Pravat remembered Jordan as a nice kid who carried himself well, but for several reasons the job didn't work, perhaps most importantly because it involved pool maintenance. Jordan simply didn't do water, never having forgotten the drowning of his young friend as a child. "We were out wading and riding the waves coming in," he would recall years later. "The current was so strong it took him under, and he locked up on me. It's called the death lock, when they know they're in trouble and about to die. I almost had to break his hand. He was going to take me with him. He died. I don't go into the water anymore. Everybody's got a phobia for something. I do not mess with water." It was also the sweeping and cleaning. Jordan admitted later to the shallowest of excuses that he feared friends would see him and tease him. He wanted no part of it, making his parents, particularly James, furious. That didn't matter. "He tried to change me," Jordan recalled, "but it never worked. I quit after a week. I said, never again. I may be a wino first, but I will not have a 9-to-5 job." Here's to you, Miss Robinson. What Michael did have that spring was that jewel of teen expectation, the junior-senior prom. Laquita Robinson did not attend Laney but lived in Goldsboro. How they met is one of the many tightly clasped secrets of the Jordan legend. It seems logical that he first stayed with her family on one of his many baseball trips. In those days, before texting, they corresponded by the U.S. Postal Service. Jordan wrote her many letters, each of them dashed off on notebook paper as he sat bored in one class or another. She kept them all, as teenage girls are known to do, and years later, two of the letters would appear on the collector's market after allegedly being purloined by one of her relatives. One of them surfaced in 2011 and sold for $5,000, but when Laquita complained, it was returned by the auction house, although not before the content made swift rounds across the internet. It revealed Jordan's awkward, somewhat careless attempts at the emotional expression common to so many teenaged males. "I was really happy when you gave me my honest coin money that I won off the bet," he wrote one day from his advanced chemistry class. "I want to thank you for letting me hold your annual. I show it to everyone at school. Everyone think you are a very pretty young lady, and I had to agree because it is very true. Please don't let this go to your head. Smile. I'm sorry to say that I can't go to the game on my birthday because my father is taking the whole basketball team out to eat on my birthday. Please don't be mad because I am trying to get down there a week from February 14th. If I do get the chance to come, please have some activity for us to do together. The young Jordan seemed quite ardent in expressing his love, yet like any young suitor, he made sure to leave himself escape routes should it turn out that his feelings were unrequited. As soon as the letter appeared in 2011, Laquita Robinson was interviewed by a variety of television crews. She was guarded in her comments, making it clear that she was appalled by the violation of her privacy. Police reports of the incident confirmed that it was not she who sought to profit from the letters. She did reveal that young Mike would often compliment her, only to take it back moments later, telling her in the process, "Don't let it go to your head." And the revelation about their undisclosed bet and his excitement at extracting coin money from her afterward suggests that his gaming instincts evolved early in his life, right along with his competitiveness. Their prom photo is a highlight of their months together. They attended in all white, she in a proper dress that rose high and tight around her delicate neck, with three-quarter sleeves that allowed her to display proudly the white wrist corsage he had bought her. Most telling was the hair. She parted it simply, right down the middle. No frills, no stacks, no bouffant, revealing her bright eyes, splendidly high cheekbones, and the open, honest smile of a gentle soul. She looked completely relaxed, seated with her hands folded contentedly across her lap. She gave the appearance of someone utterly lacking in pretension, and this at an age when young people, including Jordan himself, tended to assume poses. He stood tall beside her in white tails, one hand resting on her shoulder, the other thrust in his pocket, his youthful attempt at sophistication. The evening tie, even the carnation in his lapel, were white, and the tux, the collar of his shirt, were both too big for him. His smile, meanwhile, if it was that, was restrained, as if to say the moment was okay, but he had much bigger plans for himself. This memory ultimately would be like so many others for Jordan, not a recollection of how much fun they'd had, but more a sense of marking time, that he was on his way to somewhere else. He didn't know where just yet, but he very much wanted to know. He already had begun to acquire that sense of purpose where a lot of the common business of life was really just filling in gaps, unless he was playing basketball or baseball. Michael played for Laney that spring and earned all-city honors as a right fielder on a team that was coached by Pop Herring. He had gained strength and confidence, but he was being evaluated differently too by a coach who understood his athleticism. He also pitched for Laney, although David Bridgers seemed to be the ace of the staff. Jordan would struggle some afternoons on the mound, but he had good stuff and triumphant moments to go with the losses. Beyond that, he had a bat, which he put to work right from the start. He went 4-for-4 and drove in 3 runs as Laney pounded Southern Wayne 9-2 to open the season. He pitched against Hoggard in the second game and got shelled as he struggled with control and gave up a number of walks. He suffered a similar fate 2 games later on the mound against New Hanover. "He didn't have a lot of velocity and can throw harder than this," Herring remarked after Jordan gave up 6 runs in a 6th inning that sank the Buccaneers. Laney then lost the next game to Jacksonville despite Jordan's 2-run double in the 7th inning. Against Southern Wayne, he gave up 7 hits before being pulled in the 7th inning of another loss. Laney finally got a win against Kinston as Jordan delivered an RBI single. 3 days later, at home against Kinston, Jordan scored the winning run and turned in a 3-hit pitching performance that rewarded Herring's patience. He moved to center field and earned another RBI in a narrow loss against New Bern, then returned to the mound against Goldsboro to deliver another 3-hit victory, his 2nd against 4 losses. That was followed by his 3rd win, 6-1 against Jacksonville, as Jordan allowed no hits over 5 innings and struck out 7. Early in the game, he lost focus after disagreeing with the umpire's calls. Herring removed him, let him sit a couple of innings to calm down, then put him back on the mound, allowed under high school rules, and watched him close out the win. He had 2 hits, including a solo homer, but he took a loss in the final game of the season in Goldsboro when he came on in relief and gave up the winning run. Laney finished 8-8 in Division II and 9-11 overall. The baseball season only confirmed what had become clear during varsity basketball that year. Herring, the coach who would harvest so much contempt for the cut over the coming years, was absolutely focused on his young star's development. In late April, Chuck Curry had written a column in the Star News Sunday Sports section with a headline that read, "Laney's Jordan, versatile prep standout. Herring talked extensively about Jordan. "I think he's just an outstanding athlete, period. As a sophomore, he led the JV football team in interceptions. He chose not to play varsity football. It was a strictly family decision that he not play. Mike's a great basketball player. He's got to be one of the top five players in the state. In my book, Jordan's a high school All-American. There aren't enough words to describe him on the floor. I don't think anybody can guard him one-on-one. When he's had low-scoring games, it's because it was a slow-tempo game." Jordan had even found time to do a little jumping for the Laney track team that spring. "I love to jump," he told Curry. "That's what I do in track. I love baseball. It's my number one sport. I want to play both baseball and basketball in college. I believe basketball would be my number one priority, though, in college. I'd go basketball first and then try to walk on in baseball if I didn't get a scholarship in both. I plan to get advice from my parents and coaches." At 17, he had a clear notion of what he wanted, and he wasn't reluctant about expressing it publicly. "If I have an opportunity, I'd go pro as long as I get my education in college," he offered. "My goal is to be a pro athlete. My other goal is to just make it in college." Chapter 9. The Five-Star. Dean Smith and his coaching staff got a better look at Michael Jordan early that summer of 1980 at their camp. They took a good look at his parents, too. James and Dolores visited the camp and met Smith and his assistants, allowing both parties to bask in an early mutual admiration. Even so, the recruiting of Wilmington's undiscovered star left both parties unsure of what to make of each other. The room assignments at Dean Smith's camp suggest that the coaches had a growing interest in Jordan, although the signals were mixed. Jordan and Leroy Smith, young black men from the Coastal Plain, were housed with Buzz Peterson and Randy Shepard, white teammates from Asheville, in the mountains at the western end of the state. Peterson, who would be named North Carolina's Mr. Basketball in his senior year, was already a prime recruiting target for the Tar Heels, as was Linwood Robinson. Peterson was a veteran of Smith's camps from previous years. He and Jordan began a friendship that first week that would grow over the coming months, but it was Shepard who was placed in a group with Jordan for drills and competition. He was soon reporting to Peterson each evening about the Wilmington guard's astounding feats. "This was a type of player he'd never seen," Shepard told Peterson. Each day his amazement grew, until by the fourth day he commented that surely Jordan had the kind of talent that would take him to the NBA. The Carolina coaches were seeing the same things. What Brick Ettinger saw only confirmed his impression of Jordan from the Laney game in February. Linwood Robinson was at that session, Ettinger recalled. Buzz Peterson was there, but Michael Jordan was clearly the best player there. He was out of sight. Roy Williams reported to the coaching staff that Jordan was the best 6'4" player he had ever seen. "Very few people knew about him at that time," Williams later recalled. "Michael came and he just destroyed everybody in the camp." Williams's job at the camp was managing the ebb and flow of the various age groups during the brutal heat that week, so that each group was able to move off the outdoor courts and get some time on the big floor in air-conditioned Carmichael Auditorium, where the Heels played their games. After watching Jordan perform in some drills, Williams invited him back to play with the next group of older players coming through the gym. The coach would later recall that Jordan kept sneaking back into succeeding groups for more work that evening. The coaches saw that as proof that he loved to compete just as much as he liked the air conditioning. When the sessions ended each day, the four roommates found an easy time hanging out with each other. Jordan and Peterson in particular formed a friendship based on the fact that both players now realized they were being recruited by the Tar Heels. While Shepard and Smith had come to the camp with some hope that Carolina might be interested in them, the week confirmed that their games were better suited for smaller schools. Indeed, Leroy Smith would end up playing college basketball at UNC Charlotte and Shepard at UNC Asheville. Although Robinson and Peterson were high priorities for Dean Smith's program, by the end of the camp it seemed that Jordan was moving much closer to the top of the coaching staff's list. Dean Smith had taken the time to eat two separate meals with him at the camp, which, combined with Smith's visit with Jordan's parents, had given the coach more confidence that this kid from Wilmington was the kind of person who would fit in well in the structured basketball program. As excited as he was by the response, Jordan was not completely sold on North Carolina. An NC State fan, he had disliked UNC for so many years, and while he would eventually come to revere Dean Smith, There was something in the coach's controlling approach that left both Jordan and Herring a bit wary. "He tried to keep me hidden," Jordan recalled of Smith. At this crucial juncture in the recruiting process, Herring stepped forward with a subtle move that would open up Jordan's options. One evening at the Carolina camp, Herring mentioned to Roy Williams that he would like to get Jordan more exposure and was thinking of trying to get him into Howard Garfinkel's five-star in Pittsburgh or Bill Cronauer's BC camp in Georgia, the two main destinations for top-flight talent in the days before the grading of high school talent became big business. Williams understood that Smith didn't want word to get out about Jordan, but even as a young assistant, he was aware of the need to establish trust with a high school player's family. Williams agreed to help Herring, apparently without Smith's approval, although others would later question that. "He asked me what I thought," Williams said of Herring. "I said, I think he should go. I think it would be a great test of him. If I had my choice, I would go to the five-star camp. I thought that would be better for him because it was such a good teaching camp. It wasn't just about playing games, it was teaching the fundamentals of the game of basketball." A few days later, Williams mentioned Jordan to Tom Konchalski, who helped run the five-star camp. Konchalski, an erudite man with excellent recall who liked to quip that the most athletic thing he had ever done was jump to a conclusion, was establishing a reputation as one of the most thorough evaluators of high school basketball talent. Years later, he was quite clear about his ride with Williams that day. Roy said, "You know, there's a kid from North Carolina who may be a great player. We're not sure. He came to our team camp this summer, but we don't have a lot of great players there, and he didn't play against a lot of great competition." The two men discussed the fact that the first session of five-star camp, known as Pittsburgh One, offered the stiffest collection of talent among five-stars weeks. Roy said, "I don't know if he's good enough for Pittsburgh One," Konchalski recalled. Both Konchalski and Garfinkel clearly remember that the Carolina coaches were not yet sold on Jordan. It was almost as if this kid from Wilmington was too good to be true. So Williams and Konchalski decided that Jordan would work best in Pittsburgh 2 and possibly Pittsburgh 3, the second and third sessions of the summer. "I called Howard Garfinkel," Williams would recall, "and told him that Michael was coming and he would really be pleased with him as a player. I told Garf, he's going to be good enough to be a waiter. You see, if you could wait tables, you could go 2 weeks for the price of one. So I did call Garf and talked about the opportunity." Garfinkel recalled slightly different circumstances. He remembered getting a highly unusual call from Williams asking him to make room at the last minute in one of his camps for a recruit that Carolina was considering. "He introduces himself," Garfinkel said of his conversation with Williams. "We talk for a bit and he says, we have a player that we think is very good. He was at our camp, he won the MVP, killed everybody, but the competition wasn't that good. So we're not 100% sure. We're like 95% sure. We want to be 100. Can you get him into your camp so he can play against the best players in the country?" Never in all his decades of running camps had Garfinkel ever gotten such an unusual request. After all, Williams was merely a graduate assistant at Carolina. At first, Garfinkel didn't think he could fit Jordan in at the last minute, but Williams almost insisted that he get it done. This was Dean Smith's program calling, so Garfinkel relented and moved things around to create a spot for Jordan in the second week of his Pittsburgh camp. He even worked it out so that Jordan could attend the camp at a reduced cost by working on the camp's waitstaff. Garfinkel later heard that Smith was upset about Jordan going to the camp, but the camp owner said he never bought that story. I mean, why would Roy Williams call me and push this so strong if Dean Smith didn't want him to go? While there was nothing wrong or illegal about it, apparently the Carolina coach didn't want to be identified as the person making it happen. If anything, the circumstances revealed the tortured thinking of college coaches when it came to recruiting. Dean Smith brought dozens of highly coveted players to his programs over the years, and did so with an unparalleled integrity. He had a reputation for never promising playing time to young athletes in order to get them to sign with the Tar Heels. In addition, Smith was very good at keeping at bay recruiting's shadow game, in which rich university alumni provided recruits and their families with cash, cars, and other illegal inducements. Other coaches and other programs may have relied on such activity, but Smith had managed to succeed in the sport with few questions about his methods. That didn't mean, however, that Smith didn't have his quirks, one of which was an obsession with the image of his program. In a later era, Carolina's actions regarding Jordan might well have raised eyebrows at the NCAA, but they were clearly within the rules. Smith was, in fact, perturbed, according to Williams's memory. Williams recalled that he had some explaining to do. I said, "Coach, in my opinion, he was going to go, and I was just trying to give him some guidance about what I thought would be best for him, and Michael's family really appreciated it." The result was that the unknown player